Hello and welcome to a responsible day for the 10th day of Cheshvan. Today we're going to learn from Rav Chaim David Halevi from his Shu'ot Aseh L'Charav, the fourth volume, responsum number 37. And the question came from a new rabbi in a shul, and he was in this. He was appointed to the shul in the past year, so it was his first Simchat Torah in that shul. And this is, by the way, one of those tshuvot where Rav Chaim David Halevi doesn't tell us when he wrote the tshuva. He just tells us that he received the letter from the 10th of Cheshvan, and I accept that because I like his tshuvot, and so far I want to put them in. I don't think they outweigh all the other tshuvot, but I want to be candid about what I'm doing. So this man is the new Rav in the shul. The night of Simchas Torah, they gave him the honor of Peticha, of opening the Aron and taking out the Sefer Torah. So he opens up the Aron, he starts taking out the Sefer Torah. And the long-standing tradition is that you take out all the Sefer Torah, Simchas Torah night, and Simchas Torah day, to dance with them. And then, as he's doing this, he says, the Gabbai comes up to me and says, oh, stop, we don't take out all the Sefer Torah. That the previous rabbi had made the custom you take out half the Sefer Torah at night and half the Sefer Torah in the daytime. In the other half of the Sefer Torah you'll take out in the daytime for the Hakafot in the morning. The Rav says, I didn't want to say anything during davening, I didn't want to make a fuss, but after davening, I spoke to the Gabbai. The Gabbai says, this is what happened, that they used to take out all the Sefer Torah, and that was their custom in truth, as it is in most communities, in most shuls. But it had been a few years already that the number of people who daven in this particular shul, the shul was coming on relatively hard times in terms of numbers of mitpalim, and in specific, the younger element, the younger demographic, it was weakening and was thinning out, and therefore you didn't have so many people to carry Sefer Torah. You had 18 Sefer Torah, and you didn't have that many people who were able to carry it for long periods of times, because most of the people were, he says, old and weak, but it's unclear to me, in terms of carrying a Sefer Torah, how old you weak could be, because the worry was, or the concern was, they would hold the Sefer Torah for a little while, and then they would want to finish the Hakafah quickly so that they didn't have to hold the Sefer Torah anymore. Now, I have to say, as reading this, I don't know how old weak you have to be, meaning, if the Hakafah is going to go on for 5 minutes, let's say you want to have a 5 minutes Hakafah for each Hakafah, 7 minutes, seven Hakafot, half hour of Simchas Torah. So 5 minutes to hold the Sefer Torah can be challenging for some people. I guess that would be the issue. So if it's only 5 minutes, that would sound like it has to be elderly, weak people. Whereas if it's longer than that, then it could be meaning there are places where they want to have 2 hours of Hakafot. Then I can imagine somebody says, well, I'm going to be stuck with Sefer Torah for half an hour. That's too heavy for me, even if they're not the oldest people. But in any case, that's the situation. That because of this, the Rav decided, let's take out half the Sefer Torah at night. That way we have more people, or we can spread it out more, and we can have longer Hakafot and make the Simchat Torah, make the joy and the celebration that much more. We can extend it and therefore experience more and better and do better by our desire to show our happiness over reaching this milestone. So that's what he decided to do. So the rabbi is asking the question, says, I looked it up and I saw an Orach Chaim, Tav Reish Samach Tet, in 669, Orach Chaim, the Rama says, Ve'od Noah Gimim Edino Elu, in these places. Now it sounds like this is a Ashkenazic rabbi, because he's quoting Rama as a proof of something, and especially since the Rama says, Ve'od Noah Gimim Edino Elu, and unless you're in an Ashkenazic shul, it's not clear to me why. Meaning, sometimes you could say that the psak of the Ramah, the ruling of the Ramah, is really just the ruling that everybody accepts. It happens to be the Ramah was the one who said it. Then it wouldn't matter if you're a Sephardi or an Ashkenazi. But in this case, with the ruling of the Ramah that he found, he didn't find a ruling. He found the statement, Ve'odna, give me you know, Elu. We have a custom in these countries, Lahotzi kol Sefer Torah Shebechal, to take out all of the Sefer Torah that the shul has, and to sing and say praise to Hashem. So since that was the minhag in this shul as well, says the rabbi asking the question, he thinks the previous rabbi didn't have the right to stop the minhag, and therefore he wants to bring it back. But I think they won't listen to me. I'm worried they won't listen to me. They'll say, no, this is what we do now. So I wanted to get your approval, Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, because I've seen in your books that you care greatly about the customs of the Jewish people and not getting rid of customs of the Jewish people. I think the question, that little piece of the question, has such fascinating stuff to it, because it seems like it's an Ashkenazic rabbi, as I said before, based on the fact that he's quoting Rama. He's coming to Chaim David Halevi and saying, I want you to convince my Ashkenazic community that they have to follow Ashkenazic customs. So I know you care about custom. I think there's something a little funny about that. It comes to the answer of Chaim David Halevi is obviously too polite and too evolved, I think is the word we would say, I don't mean it that way, but too much of a Talmud Chacham, too much of a scholar and a gentleman to say anything like that. So he just says, congratulations on your new job, and he wishes him well. At the end of the tshuva, he'll also wish him well. And he says, it's true that I care very much about minhagim, but in this case, I'm not sure that it's true that you need to push to go back to the old minhag. So it's already been a few years that it's gone. So it's true. I don't like letting minhagim go. But once it's gone, then the question becomes, what's the best policy? What's the best strategy? What's the best path forward now? And he says, and it happens to be that I know that he's not the Rishon LeZion. A Rishon LeZion from the late 1800s, the 1900s, the Rav called Yisab Biracha. I think that's because his name was Yosef Shaul El Yashar. There's still a shul in Rechavia, a Sephardi shul on Jabotinsky that's known as the shul of the Yisab Biracha. That was the shul that he davened in. And he received a question from a community in Bucharest. It was very similar to the situation that you have in the question that was brought before, that this man is asking Rav Chaim David Halevi. In that case, in Bucharest, their custom was that on Simchas Torah, they would take out all of the Sifrei Torah, like the custom generally is. Maybe that means that even though it came from Ramah, lots of other communities had that because they too were turning to an Sephardic rabbi for the ruling on this issue. But then it was in the last 2 years, they say, the Rav of our shul in Bucharest saw that the nichbadim of the community, the honorable people in the community, don't carry the Torah. And they leave it to the ordinary people or to the children. So this is something that I can imagine somebody pointing out today as well, right? People, especially in very lively hakafot, very lively dancing and singing, don't want to be burdened with a Sefer Torah because it gets in the way of singing and dancing. So that's what the community of Bucharest is saying too, that the important people didn't want it. They left it for the lesser people. But the lesser people, lesser in terms of their knowledge and understanding of Torah and of the values of Torah, they didn't treat the Torah, the scrolls, properly. They handle them in ways that weren't appropriate to cover the Torah to the honor of Torah. So therefore, this Rav decided to reduce that. He would, and this, I'm sorry, so this tells you it's a Sephardic community, because he decided that they had 21 Torah scrolls in the shul. He would take out 7 at night, 7 in the morning, and 7 at mincha, because in the Sephardic custom, there are kafar at mincha as well in the afternoon as well. And that way, all of the Sefer Torah would have been taken out, just not all at one time, and then you could sort of guard them or supervise their handling better. Now, the Rav in Bucharest had argued to the Yisab Bracha. He says, if you look at the Shulchan Aruch, that the Shulchan Aruch in Tafresh Samech Tet doesn't say, he says very carefully, he says, if you read the language carefully, you can see that the minhag that he quotes is, Lotzi b'simcha Torah arvit v'shacharit kol sifrei Torah. So this Rav wanted to read it as, between Arvit and Shacharit, among all the Hakafot experiences, they take out all the Sifrei Torah, but not necessarily all at once. I'm sorry, I got the exact reverse. The person asking the question was complaining about the loss of the minhag, and he was saying, the language says very clearly, you take them all out in the night and in the morning. I was suggesting the way that the other person could say, well, no, as long as I take them all out over the course of the day, but the way the Ramah says it is, the minhag is to take them all out at night and all out in the morning. So too, there's a Maharik Kolon, who quotes a Rav Haigon. Rav Haigon says that any custom that was established for Kavod HaTorah, to express honor for Torah, Doch Afilu Iser Shivut can push aside even Durabbanan prohibitions. So exactly how far you take that would have to be known, we have to see it on a case by case. But this Rav was writing to the Yisab Bracha, says, you see, you shouldn't be pushing aside any minhagim. So this other Rav who had changed the minhag into pulling out all the 21 Sifrei Torah over the course of the three times over Simchat Torah that you have the dancing, so he says, that's got to be wrong. It goes against this Rav Haigon because it's a custom for Kavod HaTorah, and you should be using it all the time for all the Sifrei Torah through all the Hakafot, and that's the way the custom should be. And he also wrote that he had found in another sefer called Makor Baruch, who was asked about the custom on Simchas Torah, and also another custom on Simchas Torah and on Shabbos Chatuna, Ashkenazi would call an ufra. If you have a chatan before his wedding, I think it's before his wedding, it might be after his wedding, but I think it's before his wedding, that the community would gather at his home, the home of the prospective groom, the man about to get married. They would say all the psukei Zimra there until Nishmat Kol Chai, and while they were saying Pesukei Zimra, everybody would gather together at that house, and then they would dance him to shul. But what started happening was people came late. So sometime after Baruch Shema, you'd notice that so-and-so's not here yet, so-and-so's not here yet, and you're worried about getting it taken care of. So you would stop, people would stop, and they would say to the gabbai, the shamash, the person who goes and gathers people, go call so-and-so. Right? So there was one time a certain guy there, a chacham, somewhat of a Torah scholar, he didn't like that because he says you're making a hefsek between Baruch Shema and Nishmat and Nishtabach, which you're not supposed to. I would point out that Rav Chaim Halevi here uses the phrasing of the Makor Baruch that you say Nishmat, because I think it's true that I've thought about this a lot. Much people realize that I think that on Shabbat we think of Nishmat as the beginning of the Baruch of Yishtabach. It's not that we add in a separate prayer called Nishmat. I think it's that we think that Nishmat is part of that whole bracha. I'm not sure, but that would make it complicated that we switch Chazanim in the middle of the bracha. But anyway, here he refers to the fact that you can't have a hefsek, you can't have an interruption between Baruch Shemar and Nishmat, whereas usually we say you can't have a hefsek between Baruch Shemar and Yishtabach, Yishtabach is the closing bracha. So I think he's assuming that Nishmat sort of steps in to be the beginning of that bracha on Shabbos. So this Chacham was bothered by the hefsek, bothered by the interruption in davening to tell the gabbai or the shamash to go find these people. So you know what? Let's just change the custom. Instead of waiting all the way to the nishmat, we'll gather together before Baruch Shemar, and then we'll dance the chatan to shul. And everybody agreed. Everybody was happy with that. That was a fine idea, and they did. But then another Chacham came along. Another guy came along, and he said, "You can't change the minhag." The minhag was, now you change the minhag. Not only that, he said, if you wait a little longer, you're going to get more people. And when you get more people, we have a principle in halacha. This is a principle about serving Hashem. The pasuk says, Berov am hadrat melech. It's pasuk of Mishlei, chapter 14, response in pasuk chafchet, pasuk 28. So it's Berov am hadrat melech, and it's taken always to mean that all other things being equal, the more people you have, the better an honor it is to Hashem or to any melech, really, to any king. So that's relevant. That's relevant to lots of issues. So, for example, theoretically, if you had two shuls that were exactly as good as each other, and one had more people, one had fewer people, you're supposed to daven in the shul with the more people, because berovam hadrat melech. It's really true that two shuls are exactly the same. They usually each shul has advantages and disadvantages. Then you can say, no, these advantages matter so much to me, right? So if you daven, as I often do, at an earlier minyan, which is often usually a smaller minyan, the response is, yeah, but it's also usually a quieter minyan. So that may or may not be true, but something to think about. So in this case, they brought up the issue of Berov HaMadran Melech because we have another principle that a chatan dome lemelech, that a groom is similar to a king. So this guy wanted to say, see, the idea that you should have more people possible bringing the chatan and treating him like a king, that's based on this idea. And therefore, he wanted to say that his idea was that we have to go back to the old custom. So the response in that situation was, of the Makor Baruch was, no, once the custom has changed, it's okay. If everybody's agreed to the change, then you can change it. You don't have to go back to it because there's some problem in the going back to it. Anyway, the old custom had a problem to it in terms of that it was leading to interruptions. No, but if everybody agreed to this one, then that's good enough, is what he said. So now the Sabracha said, if so, when you've already changed something, and that change has gone well, and it is, and it seems to be doing fine, and it's solving a problem. So in his case, the Yisra Bracha's case, you've already taken out all the Sifrei Torah among all the times, but not all at once, but have a third of them in the nighttime davening, a third in the morning davening, a third in the afternoon davening, and everybody in the community is happy with it. And the person who changed it was for Kavarat Torah. That's an important piece of it. It wasn't like he was changing it just randomly. It was to help Kavarat Torah. Then there's no reason to go back to the old custom. He does say that if they had asked me originally, it might be that I would have said, no, you shouldn't change things because we try hard not to change customs. But once it's already been changed, been a year or two, everybody agreed, then to stop and have a fight. And to this, there's no reason to do that. Now, so Rav Chaim David HaLevi, that's all the more so in our situation. Why all the more so in our situation? Because in Bucharest, the reason why they stopped carrying the Sefer Torah, they needed to take out fewer Sefer Torah, was because members of the community, particularly the honored members of the community, the wealthy members of the community, the successful members of the community, didn't want to be bothered with carrying a Sefer Torah on Zipras Torah. So there's another solution at hand that you could have imagined. The other solution at hand you could have imagined was, so teach them better and make it clear to them, help them understand the mistake they're making when they don't follow the minhag, and explain to them that the honor is in carrying the Sefer Torah. He does throw in that maybe the Rav in Bucharest, so the Yisra Bracha, knew that the Yisra Bracha was the chief rabbi of Israel, the Rishon LeZion. Maybe he knew that it wouldn't help. But in any case, the point is there, it's based on a mistake. It's based on a lack in the community that its honored leaders were unwilling or uninterested in carrying Sifrei Torah during Simchas Torah. But in our situation, where the shul doesn't have enough young people to carry it, so it's a matter of physical abilities, and the previous rabbi saw that the lack of these abilities was leading to a lessening of Kavanah Torah, a lessening of the honor of Torah, because people were rushing through the Hakafot. So then, to change the custom makes sense, because it's the only way to do it. He's got a good reason, and everybody agreed, so there's no arguing, no fighting about it. So therefore, Rav Chaim Zalman Levi says, I don't think you have any right to go back and to change it back. And besides which, you haven't come up with a solution to the problem of there's not enough people to be carrying the Sifrei Torah. So if there are not enough people carrying the Sifrei Torah, you still have the same problem. You're going to have the same issue of the Hakafot. And so there's no reason to go back, says Rav Chaim Zalman Levi. That's especially true, says Rav Chaim Zalman Levi, because the whole reason, much of the reason not to change Minhagim, based on Rav Haigon and Marik, is that you're worried about argument, about fighting, but it doesn't sound like there's any fighting community now that it's changed, so to change back and to try to, and then to start fighting over it, doesn't make any sense, doesn't seem right to him, and therefore he closes and says, this is what you should do, but he wishes him well, that he'll be successful, and he'll attract more young people, and that by virtue of attracting young people, they'll have people to carry the Sifrei Torah, and they'll take out all the Sifrei Torah again, and the shul will go back to its glory. So that is the first of the response we're going to see, but it took us a very short bit of time. It's, I think, an interesting tshuva, but just took us short time to summarize, so we will briefly see another tshuva of Moshe Feinstein from Choshen Mishpat Bet Samach Zayin. So the second tshuva is from Moshe Feinstein from Igrot Moshe, Choshen Mishpat 267, Bet 67, Samach Zayin. And the claimants in this case, it's a Din Torah. It's not a question to him, it's a Din Torah. The claimants are a woman and her daughter and her son-in-law. And they had given, this is from the 10th of Cheshvan, of 1956, Tafshin Yud Zayin. And they had given a certain guy money, $1,000, which back then was real money, to get three other relatives out of Hungary, right? Hungary is under the, by this point, is under the thumb of the Soviet Union. And they have this woman, Sarah, and her daughter and her son-in-law have a relative, Shimon. And Shimon's parents and wife are stuck in Hungary. So this family wanted to help him out. So they had given the money, but they say that when they had given the money, they had warned him that the money has to be used by somebody they trust, and they also claim that they say, and there's a three-week time limit, meaning if you have somebody who can get them out, he can do it within 3 weeks, then here's the money, and we're happy to have you have the money, but if not, we want the money back. So he gives the money to this other guy, Rav Reuven, who's apparently supposed to be the fixer who gets people out of the Soviet Union, out of Hungary, that's under the communist regime, but it's been 5 years. So they started this whole process in 1951, and they're not out yet, and they want the $1,000 back. I just found some website online, dollartimes.com. It tells you that $10,000 in 1950, the same buying power as $102,000 in 2001. So I think that would suggest that $1,000 in 1950 would have had the same buying power as $10,000. Let me check. It's $10,230.17. So it's not an insignificant amount of money. And they want the money back because they think that they haven't gotten the job done. So it's been a couple of years already that they're doing this. It's 5 years now, but they've already been looking. So for a few years ago, after a couple of years, they went to rabbis who called them to a Beit Din, to a rabbinic court, and he didn't go. So they went to regular court. And the regular court said that he has to put the money in escrow while they figure it out. So in the figuring it out, they've now come to agree that they'll go to Moshe Feinstein for binding arbitration. So this Reuven guy says, he says he never refused to go to a Din Torah, and they're taking him to court, created a public record of this, and that embarrasses him, and that causes him financial consequences because people won't use him as their agent for various other things because they know that there's a claim against him for $1,000, and therefore he is claiming in return, and not that this will have many meaning on the outcome of the case, but I think it's just interesting to watch people and what they do. He wants $50,000 back. The damage, in other words, the damage of the claim that he owes somebody $1,000, won't pay it, he's claiming it's $50,000, which is, in today's dollars, $500,000. So it's just a classic kind of a ploy, it feels like to me. You sue somebody for $10,000, they say, oh, and I'm countersuing you for $500,000 in damages. He also said he was never told that there's any such condition as the three-week condition, and he says you can't make a time for these kinds of things, because when it comes to communist Russia, to the Soviet Union, and the country's controlled by the Soviet Union, it's not that kind of a thing. If you get into areas where rule of law isn't as strong as we would like it to be. Even in America, the truth is, if you went to a lawyer and said, I want this money recovered in X amount of time, I think he would often say to you, you can't always guarantee that it's going to go because things take longer than you'd like them to, and various things happen and come up and issues and that. Can't do it. And he says he's still involved in saving these people. He wants to get these three people out. He still thinks there might be a chance to do it. So again, he may be sincere, or he may be the kind of person who always says, guys, people who are in that kind of a business are always invested in assuming that they're going to be able to succeed. So it may be that he's saying it honestly, but he may be saying it, and he says, and the money's already set aside for them, and I don't have the right to return it, because then I'll stop looking for them, but I've already taken on the goal of helping these people get out of the communist regimes, out of Hungary. Now, Shimon, the relative whose relatives are still stuck in Hungary, he also says that they didn't make a time with him. And so that when he gave the money to this Rav Reuven, this Shimon says, and I did it because he was a trustworthy guy to me, and he was a good friend to my father, and I know, and therefore I trust that he's doing his best. So that's Shimon, meaning the relatives who gave the money are saying, we said 3 weeks. The relative whose relatives are in Hungary, he has a stake in saying this too, but he says there was no time limit on it, and the man that I gave the money to, he has a stake in saying this as well. So I'm not saying he's right, but his claim is, I gave it to a guy I trust implicitly and who has a personal connection to my father, so I have every reason to think that he will be doing his best to get him out. So these are Moshe Feinstein's conclusions. He says, I looked carefully into it, and I had the Din Torah, and I went through it, I listed all the sides, and this is what I think. So the first thing is, the whole claim about being embarrassed, even though they didn't have the right to go to court, they don't have to pay for the embarrassment claim, even if it causes them some kind of financial loss, because there's no such thing as a Talmid Chacham in our day, whatever it is. Because the halacha in the Ramah is that if somebody's not a Talmid Chacham, then embarrassment doesn't count the same way. We don't figure out these things. And even in cases where we are obligated financially for embarrassment, that would be a Talmid Chacham Muflag Biyotah, a really exceptional Talmid Chacham who served as a Gadol HaDor, and this. And it's also true, and this is based on that, see, it's in Simon Reish Mem Gimel, the laws of how we treat Torah scholars, I think it is, in Shulchan Aruch and Yeridea. So there too, he says, if the Talmid Chacham was the one who started the fight, so then the financial penalties for embarrassing this person go away as well. So that is not an issue. Now, the claim about the 3 weeks, Rosh Feinstein says, even if it were true, it can't have been taken literally, because everybody knows that when it comes to getting people out of Hungary, there's no way you can set a time limit like that. So Rosh Feinstein thinks it becomes something where we assume was understood to be lezaruze be'alma. It was a way of putting on pressure to say, please make sure to have it go faster. Even if they actually said the words, it can't be considered as a real halachic tnai. Not only that, this Reuven got the money from a Shimon, from the man whose relatives are still stuck in Hungary, not from the people who provided the money. So he doesn't have to believe the third party that they had made it tonight, because he can just say, I didn't hear of it tonight from Shimon. And there's every reason to think he didn't hear from a condition from Shimon, because Shimon himself says there was those conditions. So that makes sense that it all worked out that way. So if there's still meaningful hope that you can get these people out of Hungary, I don't know how you define that. That's what Moshe Feinstein says. You have to leave the money there because the money's being put to good use to drag the people out. Actually, yeah, until you give up. So I don't know what give up means, because theoretically, if this Reuven wants to hold on to the money, he'll just say, well, I never give up. Right? Who knows what will happen? In a year from now, it could be okay. It could be this. It could be right now. I think it has to mean whatever current efforts that this Reuven is making with whatever current officials, as long as that system is in place that gives him reason to believe that he might have influence on it, that would be it. But other than that, it just seems odd to me, because you could say, oh, well, I think in 30 years the Berlin Wall is going to fall, and then all of communism is going to fall, and then the borders are going to open, and I'm going to be trying until then. So that's an odd thing. I don't think that it doesn't sound like that's what Moshe Feinstein means, right? Yeush is very often a very personal thing. I think he means it's more like when there's objective markers of yeush, there are objective reasons to believe that there's no more chance to get them out, and this Reuven will have to admit to it and then give the money back. And interestingly, when he gives them the money back, the Moshe Feinstein says, and by the way, that $1,000 was split up in the following ways. It was $200 from Sarah, and $50 from her son-in-law, and $200 from her daughter. So that makes up $450. And the rest, the son-in-law collected $250 from people. And he went around collecting. People gave him money that he knew. And then $300 the daughter got as well. So if this Reuven says, you know what, it's just not going anywhere. I in fact have to concede defeat, and we're not going to be able to get them out right now. We're going to have to wait for maybe the winds of change to come. If he admits that, what he's going to have to return is only the money of the people who are demanding it. But the people who gave the money as a donation, right, that the son-in-law or the daughter collected from friends and acquaintances, so that's keset tzedaka. So keset tzedaka, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, kimotar shavoi lishavoi. There's halacha. You collect money to redeem a captive, and that captive ends up getting redeemed for less money than you know, comes in under budget. That extra money doesn't go back to the donors. It goes for other people who are captured and you want to try to help free. So here too, you'd keep that extra money. It's stuck on money that's supposed to go this, and this Reuven would have to use it for other people stuck in Hungary, or for providing money for people in Hungary who are stuck and unable to support themselves there, and use the money for those purposes. But the people who demanded it from him, then he'd have to give it back to them. So to me, that's an odd psak. I'm not questioning it in the sense of it's wrong, and I wouldn't ever say that, but it's odd just because he says if the other people got and demanded it back, they get demanded back as well, but they have to come and demand it. Meaning, it's one thing if you say to me that motor shvoyim l'shavoy, that the extra money goes for other similar causes. You say once you gave money to tzedakah, you gave money to tzedakah, and it's gone. But it's not quite what he's saying, because then that should have been true theoretically for these people as well. So the answer is it wasn't given for captives in general. It's given for this captive, and this captive isn't being released right now. And therefore, I would think theoretically it should go back. And once it's going back, I would have thought that it should go back to all the people, and they shouldn't have to, you know, it's a little unfair to them to say they gave money for a cause. It's not going to be used for that cause, and unless they're smart enough to come back and demand it, they won't get it back. So anyway, that's the way he passed in that situation. So then expenses becomes an issue, because let's say he's already spent money on this effort, and that's part of the money that was collected, but the efforts didn't go anywhere. So they say, well, you wasted the money because you spent it on you used it on expenses that weren't important. So there, Rav Moshe Feinstein thinks that because they had said the 3 week condition, even though it didn't count as a real condition, it might have counted that it meant and don't spend any money unless you're confident that money will have productive outcomes, and therefore when they're claiming the money back, it might be that they should be able to get it back. Even she says he made a pshara between them, made a compromise, and he would only take half the expenses. So it turns into a whole big bruch for them, because there's obviously bad feelings all around, and this Reuven is going to feel like he's a guy who makes a living or spends his time trying to help Jews get out of wherever they're getting out of, and he takes money from people in his mind, and I bet he wasn't a wealthy man. In his mind, he's putting himself out, try to save other Jews, and now he's being accused of all these things. So, but that's the way the compromise goes. That's the way it happens in life. And everybody finds says, and when it comes to setting a time limit, because the 3 weeks we agreed is not a meaningful thing. But I pointed out that the Yeush standard isn't a great standard either, because who knows when they could be never extended. So, because you don't want to just leave it, and there is a requirement, which the Feinstein says, "Lotzia at that moment hashad," and we should all try our best to make sure that people don't have room to suspect us of mishandling situations. So this Rav Reuven has that obligation as well, and you don't want people walking around, whether or not they're right. You don't want people walking around saying, "Oh, him, he cheated families out of this and this and this." So because of that, Rav Moshe Feinstein said he says it's arbitrary. It's not because there's any good reason for this standard. It's arbitrary, but he just set it up that if by Pesach of Tavshin Yud Chet, so this is a tshuva from the 10th of Cheshvan of Tavshin Yud Zayin, so he's giving him a year and a half more to try to get these people out of Russia, out of Hungary. If he doesn't do it by then he should return the money to the family. And that is a short brief tshuva by Rav Moshe Feinstein. Our main tshuva, although I took almost as much time for that, but our main tshuva was about when you do it, no change customs. Chaim David HaLevi about the custom of taking Sifrei Torah out of the Aron, and when we would try to force a custom to go back when it was wrongly changed, when it's wrong to change it, and things like that. And then we also had a brief tshuva by Rav Moshe Feinstein about what you do in a financial argument when one side says they made certain conditions, and the issue was saving Jews from Hungary when it was still under the control of the Soviet Union. Have a great day.